I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Where are we on foreclosures now that two of the largest mortgage holders, Bank of America and GMAC, say they're beginning procedures again? There'd been a halt on foreclosures after it was discovered that inexperienced agents were robo-signing documents. One GMAC executive testified he signed 10,000 documents in 1 month. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs said today that a federal task force is looking into errors in foreclosure documents, but foreclosures begin again. Nelson Schwartz is covering the story for the New York Times. Nelson, welcome.
Good to be here.
And Nelson, we're reminded that it was your paper that told us about the lawyer who broke the story of robo-signing. This was Thomas Cox up in Maine. He's a volunteer who just happened to pull a woman's file and found that her bank officer didn't have loan documents, didn't go to a notary, didn't know anything about her foreclosure, and he robo-signed off on it. And this led to the discovery that thousands of foreclosures were being robo-signed. Well, now Bank of America says it can't find a single example of an erroneous foreclosure. So what does this mean? Does this mean that despite robo-signing, the foreclosures were valid? I mean, what is Bank of America saying?
I think the argument is that while there may have been errors in paperwork, there was no one who was not delinquent on their loans who was facing foreclosure, against this argument from lawyers saying, well, due process wasn't filed, and even if the people were behind, that doesn't mean you can just ride roughshod with incomplete or erroneous paperwork. But there are reasons for the economy that some people don't favor a nationwide mortgage foreclosure moratorium, because then all these houses will sit on the market and sort of the housing market will grind to a halt.
Well, for instance, what had been happening for Bank of America as the foreclosures were on hold?
Bank of America's stock was really pummeled by investors last week because of fears of how much this foreclosure halt would cost them and just overall how much, you know, the overall, you know, sort of mortgage bond mess will cost. And it's a major worry for investors, and they actually released earnings today. And an even bigger issue than just the foreclosure controversy is the question of whether the mortgage-backed securities that the bank sold to investors and to the government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, were put together fraudulently. If they were, some of these investors could force the banks to buy them back, and that could be multi-billions of dollars.
But, Nelson, doesn't one have to do with the other? In other words, when a house is going into foreclosure, isn't this the time to find out who owns it? You know, what's the real paperwork? Who owns the mortgage? To sort of figure out at least the end what happened at the beginning.
Well, that's an excellent point. I think they are, though, two separate things. I mean, I think it goes back to what we were discussing earlier, whereas are these paperwork errors or do these people in the bank size deserve to be foreclosed upon? I mean, i.e., are they behind in their payments?
Yeah. Well, Nelson, what are the banks saying they're going to do going forward? Critics have said there hasn't been enough time for them to set up some sort of infrastructure to stop the robo-signing. So are they going to continue the foreclosures with robo-signing?
They're not going to continue with robo-signers, at least they say they won't, and they are adding people to this effort, and they've actually added hundreds of people just to do this review. But in talking to lawyers, they're skeptical. I mean, one lawyer we talked to said, you know, essentially how could they just in a few weeks review 100,000 cases? And I think the next thing to watch is what happens in Washington, whether any kind of political momentum builds for a moratorium, because it doesn't look like this moratorium is going to last much longer.
Well, and there's a possible conundrum there, which is that the government, the Treasury, now runs some of the biggest mortgage holding companies, so there's an interest in getting the foreclosures moving because of that as well. One of the anecdotes we've heard is that somebody bought a foreclosed home at one of those sales that are held on town hall steps. We've been seeing them. And, you know, they bought themselves a very inexpensive, they thought, $137,000 mortgage, and then found out that, in fact, that was only one of two mortgages on this foreclosed home because of the lack of paperwork. And now they find themselves holding another huge mortgage in addition. Isn't that one of the problems that can come out of not understanding what the paperwork is?
I mean, it is, and it's, I think, from the beginning of this mortgage mess, you know, even from when these loans were first taken out, people did not understand what they were doing. At each stage in the game, the system sort of favored a quick resolution rather than necessarily a correct one.
Nelson Schwartz of the New York Times, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the state of Montana is standing up for a state's right to ban direct corporate spending on political campaigns. Montana says it has a unique history with a nearly century-old law banning direct corporate spending in response to how the mining industry once corrupted state politics. But that old law was challenged by three groups: the Western Tradition Partnership, a conservative think tank; Champion Painting, a business based in Bozeman; and the Montana Shooting Sports Association, which is a gun rights advocacy group based in Missoula. Yesterday, a district judge in Helena, Montana, ruled in their favor, agreeing with the recent Supreme Court decision. The judge wrote, "The First Amendment protects the political speech of corporations." Well, with us is Montana State Attorney General Steve Bullock. Attorney General Bullock, are you going to appeal the state court's decision?
Yeah, we are going to appeal it. Ultimately, we knew that would end up in front of our Montana Supreme Court, and they'll be looking at it anew.
Well, but as you well know, the Supreme Court has made a ruling. So tell us a little bit more about what you think is the uniqueness of Montana. Let's just flesh that out a little bit. What was happening that back in 1912, I think it was, Montanans voted 3-1 in an initiative to ban corporate spending? What was going on?
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. The Copper Kings, and it's often referred to as the Copper Collar, I mean, mining interests really ruled this state. At one point, the U.S. Senate refused to seat William Clark because of the rank corruption of buying a legislative seat. I mean, we had a race to decide where that the state capitol would be located. And at the time, there was $35 to $70 million in today's dollars spent to influence 52,000 voters.
We understand that is about $1,000 per vote.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we had a past where, I mean, even newspaper editors at the time were saying around the turn of the century that the question of the day would be whether the people would control the corporations or the corporations would control the people. Based on that history, as you said, by about, you know, a three-fourths vote, that Montanans went to the polls and said, we're not going to allow corporations to buy our elections, and we're not going to allow corporations to make expenditures in our elections. These are elections for the people.
Well, this was specifically referred to back then as the Montana problem. And District Judge Jeffrey Sherlock cited that history yesterday. He ruled in the Montana court yesterday against the Citizens Initiative. And he said that the political corruption did exist in the state, but that was a long time ago. He said the Copper Kings are a long time gone to their tombs. Doesn't he have a point?
Well, we're hopeful that the Supreme Court will look at the overall record. I mean, we had people providing testimony from that had a lifetime experience in Montana politics on both sides, Democrats and Republicans, saying that this will actually corrupt, given the fact that Montana's electoral system, I think, is a little bit different. Our average state Senate race is $17,000. If you looked at every race at the state level in 2008, I mean, they spent less in total. The 327 people running for office spent less than the average U.S. Senate race.
Well, what you're saying is that in Montana, because elections are such low-dollar affairs, it's easier for money to influence them?
Well, it's more than just that. Based on the Corrupt Practices Act of 1912, we do have a different system. We do have a grassroots political system. The vibrancy of that democracy could change if it all becomes about money, not about, you know, the voters and the electorate.
Well, let's listen to what one of the plaintiffs said. This is Donald Ferguson, Western Tradition Partnership's executive director. Again, this is a conservative think tank and activist organization. And he said the First Amendment was intended to protect citizens from the government, not to shield politicians from criticism. He says that while you may be saying that you want to keep just Montana voices in the election process, if there's a critic of a politician, they have every right to have their voice heard, even if that critic is a corporation.
And they certainly do, and corporations and everybody have been active in Montana through segregated funds. Corporate interests through political action committees are as vibrant as any other interest. So we don't believe, first of all, that they really have been hindered.
Well, are you also worried about what's been happening in other states? This Supreme Court decision has opened up a floodgate of money that's been funneled into, in some cases, quickly set up nonprofits so that you don't get to know, because nonprofits don't have to disclose donors, you don't get to know whose money it is.
And that's the exact sort of organization that the Western Traditions Partnership is. I mean, already has a number of complaints in front of our Commissioner of Political Practices for setting up organizations that really have nothing to do with their interests going into elections. And you don't have an idea who's spending. Ultimately, I mean, we want to know whose voice it is out there. Part of that's a disclosure issue, but as we're seeing all around the country, even with disclosure laws, I mean, this money's being funneled from one organization to another organization to another, and it's being spent on, you know, issues and, I guess, ads that have nothing to do with the interest behind the money.
We're talking to Montana State Attorney General Steve Bullock, who's going to appeal yesterday's Montana court decision that overturns an almost century-old law in Montana that bans corporate spending on political campaigns. And Attorney General Bullock, you're mounting kind of a lonely defense here. There are 24 states with limits on corporate spending, but right now you're the only one defending the constitutionality of spending limits. Where do you think this will go? Do you think other states will join you?
I think that, you know, other states are taking a look at it. But I think that it's critical that when we think about both Montana's history and what the U.S. Supreme Court had in front of it. I mean, they had a challenge to an act that had been passed by Congress about a decade ago, not the State Corrupt Practices Act that was passed by the people of Montana a century ago. And the vast majority of elections in America occur at the state and local level. That wasn't the focus of the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United. So I really think in some respects there's some apples and oranges here. And when you start to dig into what happens at the state and local level, it is significantly different than the feds. That's why we're defending our century-old law. And I imagine that other states are kind of taking a look at how it works in their states as well.
Well, one last question. David Brooks writes today in the New York Times. He has an op-ed in which he writes, "Don't follow the money." And he concludes, "In this day and age, money is almost never the difference between victory and defeat. It's just some primitive mythology. It's a talisman. It makes people feel good because they think it has magical properties. But it doesn't really affect elections."
You know, I think even a century ago when William Clark was in front of the U.S. Senate, he said, you know, it's gotten to the point there's so much money in politics that he said it takes a lot of people. I got to go out, takes a lot of men to get people to the vote. I think ultimately that money can drown out and make it so it's more than just, you know, it's not just a lot of corporate dollars in it. It's the people wondering if they really have any role in the electoral system.
Montana State Attorney General Steve Bullock, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Robin.
Okay, just ahead, we're going to stay with corporate spending. The White House had to back down on its claims that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is supported by foreign funding. But supporters of the chamber are conflating that huge lobbying group with the mom-and-pop hardware store down the block from you. Is that working? And later, the blogger who sparked outrage at a Muslim community center in New York has now called for a boycott of that iconic Andy Warhol symbol of America, Campbell's Soups. We'll find out why. Back in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. You may remember our reporting when President Obama, citing a liberal blog, made the claim that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was running attack ads funded in part by foreign money. The White House had to back off those claims. There is no proof of foreign funding, and the chamber says the money it gets from overseas is in the form of dues from members, not donations. But the dust-up revealed once again the confusion over the chamber itself. Conservative talk show host Glenn Beck, outraged by the president's statements, called on listeners to support the chamber, whatever it is.
You know what the chamber is? The chamber is a group of businessmen, and aren't most of the businesses under 100 people that are at the members of the chamber?
I believe so, yeah.
So these are companies that have under 100 employees, for the most part. These are your local downtown businesses.
Well, that's just not true. Glenn Beck ended up donating $10,000 of his own dollars to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and said his father, who owned the family bakery, was a member, but he's probably not talking about the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Michael Crowley is senior correspondent and deputy Washington bureau chief for Time magazine. Michael, remind us, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is what? The mom-and-pop chambers that are in our local towns are what?
Well, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is essentially the Washington advocacy and lobbying arm of the American business community. The chambers of commerce in your small town provide serve a very different function, that it's very local and, generally speaking, not political. It might often be something as simple as sponsoring parades on the downtown street. What's happening here in Washington is tens of millions of dollars of lobbying on Capitol Hill, and now in this election season, about $75 million in political advertising, largely in support of Republican candidates and attacking Democrats. And they are two very different things, although Democrats are dismayed that many Americans associate the Chamber of Commerce with the kind of mom-and-pop style operations on Main Street.
Right. Well, the Obama administration had some egg on its face after its claim that there was foreign monies, although they went on to say, who knows who contributors to nonprofits like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce are, because they don't have to be disclosed. But, you know, moving forward, who wins here? Did Glenn Beck's call, again appealing to people's sense of small mom-and-pop chambers of commerce, but did his call bring the big U.S. Chamber of Commerce a lot of money?
He did bring the chamber a good chunk of money. I don't offhand remember the dollar figure, but I do remember that it was non-trivial, but also in the context of the $75 million the chamber is going to be spending this year, it's not any kind of a game changer. No one is going to win or lose a congressional seat. The chamber has so much money. And just to go back to your earlier point about what is the U.S. chamber versus the local chamber, we don't know, because the chamber won't disclose who its donors are, and that gets to the heart of the frustration of the Obama White House. But we don't know exactly where that political budget comes from. It's not just their dues. It's coming from contributions from their member companies. The LA Times earlier this year, looking back at tax records, I think, that were a couple years old, was able to figure out that a very large proportion of the chamber's political budget came from a very small number, relatively speaking, of corporations. Even though the corporations are not identified by name, the line item donations are broken out in the tax records. So the point is that these are big corporations giving big money, even with Glenn Beck's listeners lending a hand. I don't think it makes that big a difference relative to what are probably large multinational corporations giving six- and seven-figure contributions.
In fact, I'm looking at your writing, and you say the LA Times examination of tax records found that a third of the chamber's 2008 revenue came from just 19 companies or individuals who gave between $1 million and $15 million each. Certainly not mom-and-pop organizations.
Right.
And you know, as far as the disclosure, we should say that there are hundreds of nonprofits now not disclosing contributors and running attack ads. Of course, we know by law, nonprofits are not supposed to spend more than 50% of their time on political activity, but nobody is following through on that for any of the nonprofits. And it would seem the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is pretty political.
That's right. We're in a kind of a Wild West right now. There are these strange loopholes in the tax code, and campaign finance regulation is very lax right now. So groups that are ostensibly not created to influence elections are spending huge amounts of money, tens of millions of dollars, in a pretty clearly political way, without having to disclose their donors. Disclosure is sort of a bedrock of campaign law in almost every other category in America, but because there are these kind of strange loopholes, and because for various reasons campaign finance regulation and enforcement is quite weak right now, you again have this sort of Wild West atmosphere where people are raising and spending money left and right with very little public information about where it's coming from.
Well, and again, as we said, the Obama administration with a little egg on its face, but did they win at all in this dust-up?
Well, I think it remains to be seen, obviously, how things shake out on Election Day. I think this story is still circulating and people are still absorbing it. I know that some Democratic strategists are skeptical of this. They think it's kind of thin gruel, that you ought to be having something better to show for yourself in the closing days of the election. On the other hand, you know, the story definitely is still alive. People are talking about it. The White House seems to be happy to keep talking about it. I think their hope is that their liberal base voters, some of whom may be disappointed disappointed in the president, had higher expectations for him than they have seen realized, might be getting fired up by, you know, feeling like this is the president having made the right enemies, big corporations out to get him, maybe a reminder to them that, you know, some kind of classic left-right liberal-conservative divides, sort of the populist little guy versus the big corporation, might be something that turns out a few more Democrats on Election Day. I think right now it's a little hard to say, but we will know in a couple weeks.
Michael Crowley, Senior Correspondent and Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Time Magazine, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's take a second to take a quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, military analyst Andrew Bacevich will join us to talk about the tense relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan. Also, we'll take a listen to the found sound compositions from the experimental music group The Books. This is from their new CD, The Way Out. What is that? We'll find out tomorrow. Latest news is next, Here and Now. In the Rockies, quaking aspens and tamarack are turning a brilliant gold. Vermont is in the mid to late stages of color, but still brilliant. Virginia's Shenandoah Valley, the peak is just beginning. In California, peak colors are expected in the eastern Sierras this week. Every fall, we're reminded, some of those fall colors are actually in the leaves all along. We just can't see them because of the green chlorophyll. But as the days shorten, the trees stop producing chlorophyll, making the yellows and browns more visible. And with cooler weather come the chemicals which create the brilliant reds and red browns. We want to check today on leaf peeping with David Wolf, professor of horticulture at Cornell. Professor, we know that cool nights and sunny days are best for fall colors, but you've also been looking into research on the effects of climate change, so tell us about that.
There was a recent study where they looked at satellite imagery data where they can see what the so-called green wave when things green up in the spring, and they can also see when the green fades as fall comes in the later part of the summer and early fall. And indeed, fall has been delayed by as much as 4 to 6, even 8 days, different parts of the northern hemisphere since the early 1980s. So there's definitely been an overall trend for a delay in fall with the warmer temperatures.
Dare we say global warming? I mean, we know that the University of Vermont is studying this. Mm-hmm. You know, they say that preliminary results indicate these cooler temperatures promote the production of red pigment, and right. Warmer climate is potentially going to reduce the vividness of the hues. And one of the research associates says maybe we won't see as brilliant color in the future. Are you seeing that?
Yeah, I think, you know, this summer is an example where we've had, you know, particularly warm summer and also some dry conditions, and that's definitely reduced that red color pigment from showing up so much. And also just that whole process of where the leaf begins to cut off the nutrients, reduce the recycling of chlorophyll and all of that can be delayed a bit. So we really see that not only from this satellite imagery, which looks at the big picture, what's happening at the planet scale, but also a number of experiments where people have really monitored very carefully for the timing of both early leaf emergence in the spring, and that's coming earlier, and the fall drop and the fall color change is happening later.
Well, Appalachian State University is also studying the impact of high carbon dioxide levels. Mm-hmm. They say that these delay what we're talking about, the aging of leaves, even without rising temperatures.
Right. Well,
so what are you saying here? I mean, obviously this would be devastating for states that depend on leaf peepers for their tourism dollars. But what does it do to trees if the colors aren't changing the way they used to?
Oh, it has all kinds of effects. I mean, one thing we kind of are concerned about as ecologists is the synchrony between species. For example, if plants are flowering earlier in response to climate change, are their pollinators responding in exactly the same way? The overall longer growing season that we're tending to see, well, this could be a good thing in some cases. The plants out there in the forest with their leaves not only doing photosynthesis but also losing water via transpiration can actually suck the soil dry prematurely. We may have more droughts, reduced stream flow, reduced water availability for humans. One sort of unexpected phenomenon with the warmer winters, we're actually seeing more freeze damage. And what one explanation for this, for example, is we can have a very warm December, but then if January comes on in sort of its normal level of cold, the plants are not properly hardened. There's a whole kind of physiological process
right.
They have to go through for that. Another problem we see on the other end of winter is plants with the warmer winter, late winter, can leaf out prematurely. And then we still have a spring frost, and so we're actually seeing more spring frost damage in some years. So it's kind of one of these paradoxes of climate change. And also just, you know, we've learned the lesson already with that, that we have to kind of expect the unexpected.
Yikes. I thought we were going to have a pleasant chat about, you know, the colors of the leaves, but as it turns out, there's a little bit of a canary in the coal mine for us.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, plants are very sensitive weather instruments, you might say.
David Wolfe, professor of horticulture at Cornell, Apennithica, New York. His book on soil ecology, Tales from the Underground, A Natural History of Subterranean Life. Professor, thank you.
Sure, thanks. Nice talking with you, Robin.
And by the way, you can take a look at some of the beautiful fall colors from around the country at our website, hereandnow.org. Thank you for that picture of the cranberry bog. Listeners have submitted photos, and we'd love to get some of yours as well. Just go to hereandnow.org. Back in 30 seconds, Here and Now. We were recently reading a New York Times profile of blogger Pamela Geller, who launched that protest against the proposed Islamic Community Center in New York. At the end of the very long article, it said that Geller had called on her readers to boycott Campbell's Soup because the company planned to certify products as halal. Halal is the Muslim equivalent of kosher. It's an inspection and certification of the way animals are slaughtered. It also prohibits food from even coming into contact with ingredients even close to alcohol, like vinegar. Halal-certified foods are big business around the world. This past January, Campbell Company of Canada did introduce 15 halal-certified soups into that country. But Geller says Campbell's gets its certification from the Islamic Society of North America, which she says is a front for terrorists. And now over 3,500 people have joined a new Facebook group called Boycott Campbell's Soup. John Faulkner is Campbell's Soup brand communications director. John, why did Campbell Canada, first of all, choose to have a number of soups halal certified?
Our colleagues up in Canada really looked at the demographics, and there are over 1 million Muslim consumers in Canada out of a population of 30 million or so. So it was a relatively sizable subgroup of the total population and fairly concentrated in Toronto, for example. They could reach out to and identify that, hey, we've got 15 soups that fit your dietary lifestyle requirements.
And you do this with other groups as well, right? You have soups that are kosher certified.
We have done that in the past. Yes, we have kosher certified soups. We also have kosher certified breads for our Pepperidge Farm line. We also highlight other dietary situations.
Well, but as you well know, the fact that you have halal certified soups has bloggers up in arms, consumers threatening to switch to Progresso. So first of all, tell us, what does it mean to make a soup halal?
Basically, we asked, we worked with the Islamic Society of North America to review the ingredients in our soups and the processes we use to make those soups. So all these soups are vegetarian, and the key element, as I understand it, is that in the processing, the ingredients would not come in contact with pork or alcohol in the process of utilizing the ingredients to make the soups that are subsequently identified as halal.
You mentioned the Islamic Society of North America. In 2008, the U.S. government publicly identified this group and hundreds of others as unindicted co-conspirators in the Holy Land Foundation terrorism case. Now, this was the case of a foundation, the Holy Land Foundation, that was convicted of laundering money to support terrorism. But the Islamic Society of North America was never the subject of a criminal investigation, never charged with any crime. They're now represented by the ACLU, which says there's no evidence of any terrorist ties. But going into your relationship, did you have any concerns about the Islamic Society of North America?
Well, we really didn't. Our folks up in Canada reached out to the Food and Consumer Products Association of Canada, asked, you know, who's the leading halal certifier. Really, ISNA was identified as the one certifier for Canada. They'd worked with a number of other Canadian food companies. Our Canadian counterparts worked with them, had these soups certified, and announced that in the marketplace back in January.
Well, in addition, you're far from even the first company to be doing this. I mean, Nestle set up its halal committee back in the 80s. They have facilities to keep halal and non-halal products separated.
Right.
They sold $3.6 billion last year. 75 of Nestle's 456 factories are geared for halal production. What do you think of this boycott against you, Campbell's?
Well, I think, you know, one, it's a relatively small group of folks that have, quote-unquote, joined the boycott through a Facebook page. And, you know, we've also had traffic on our Campbell's Condensed Facebook page and a lot of dialogue on the discussion board. We don't think it's impacting our business, but...
But what if it does? I mean, the same person who called for the boycott against you may have successfully shut down the building of a community center in New York.
At this point, you know, we're trying to stick to the facts. We've got 15 soups in Canada, not in the United States. We haven't hidden the fact that they are halal certified. We announced it publicly. We promoted it. Obviously, when we took note of the boycott last week, when it came to our attention, you know, we addressed it with the facts. And we went back through our folks internally to say, okay, how do we, you know, what's the situation with Islamic Society of North America? We're very comfortable with the group. They've tried to distance themselves from any of the sort of, you know, linkage to terrorism, violence, Hamas, etc. And we support that. We don't see that linkage at all. But the language around an unindicted co-conspirator, you know, it's a lightning rod type of thing. And misunderstood, frankly.
Well, John, you've said that Campbell won't be selling halal certified soups in the U.S. because there isn't a large enough market. Mm-hmm. And there has been controversy overseas. There was a burger chain in France. 22 of its 300-something stores went all halal hamburger, and some people protested that they were being discriminated against because they didn't have regular hamburgers. So there was some upset there. But what we're gathering is that, by and large, the rest of the world is really, you know, leaps and bounds ahead of the U.S., that they see this as a huge market.
Well, it is a big market. The Muslim population is obviously growing fast around the world. But again, our marketers look at their individual markets and identify the best opportunities. We're going to continue to market products that help consumers make informed choices, you know, wherever we sell our products around the world.
Is Campbell's going to do anything to address some of the posts on Facebook and elsewhere? Here's one saying, I'm not going to buy any products of Campbell's. She jumps ahead to say, I'm not against people believing what they want. I'm against those who would destroy the USA. Mm-hmm. And the Muslim world has ordered a jihad against the USA. Now, we know the Muslim world hasn't ordered a jihad against the USA. The extreme factions have. But are you going to try to engage in any dialogue with any of these people?
You know, this is kind of the ultimate challenge. You know, you get into a dialogue with that sort of point of view, and we can point to what the Islamic Society of North America has stated on their website, how they've distanced themselves from the accusations that have been made against them. But this sort of point of view is awful hard to debunk with facts, frankly. It's so emotional. Campbell's were an iconic brand, well known by you know, basically everybody in America. We're 99% of homes with our brand over the course of a year. So, you know, people attach a lot of emotion to our brand. And in fact, you know, we do too as a company. So we take, you know, these accusations that were linked to a terrorist group and terrorism to heart, because post 9/11, we were up at ground zero with over 100 Campbell employees serving our soups to the rescue workers and to the news media who were gathered there covering that story for 2 weeks, 24/7. So, you know, it sort of predated Twitter, predated Facebook, so no one was online saying, I'm here at ground zero serving my chunky soup. But that's where we were, and we didn't reach out to get any notoriety for that. People felt really good about what we could do to help out at a terrible time. We were there to do the right thing.
And so you feel this is undeserved?
Well, I think that the suggestion that Campbell's Soup Company is aiding and abetting terrorism is very, very much undeserved.
John, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. It's been enjoyable being with you today.
Not too long ago, Doctors Naylene Lai and Julie Cardos were pediatric residents at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, where they began writing a blog, Two Peds in a Pod. That's peds as in pediatricians. And they had items like the scoop on poop, how to get rid of the binky. We'll link to their website at hereandnow.org. But meanwhile, they're both now practicing pediatricians in the Philadelphia area and join us from the studios of WHYY in Philly. Dr. Lai, are you there?
Yes.
Well, and welcome to you. And Dr. Cardos, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What do you think it is that makes your blog different from, you know, WebMD or some of the others that are out there?
Well, this is Dr. Lai. And does WebMD talk about what to do about stinky feet from Uggs or I Love Boobies bracelets? Or on a personal level, I don't think WebMD can share personal experiences in the intensive care unit. And we like to think of ourselves as part social commentary as well as medical advice.
Okay, we got to back up here. Mm-hmm. What's a boobie bracelet?
You don't know what a boobie bracelet is?
I somehow missed this.
They're hidden in the back of, ironically, the boys' skateboarding stores, and they actually benefit a breast cancer research foundation.
Oh.
But they do say on them, "I love boobies." And, of course, this is the newest rage to hit our
kids. Oh, yes, I do. Actually, I do know about these. And what's your take on that, by the way?
They're a wonderful cause, and we used it as a way to remind people to do breast exams. You know, the American Medical Association, the American Cancer Society don't actually recommend breast exams until 20 years old, self-breast exams, that is. But kids are breasts are lumpy and bumpy, and kids need to know their baseline before that point.
Well, let's just stay with the silly, and by that I mean these bracelets the kids are wearing, and we'll get to other serious issues. What do you think of the silly bands?
This is Dr. Carter's talking. You know, there's always a dark side to everything. I think the kids love them, but silly bands are just rubber bands, so they're a choking hazard, so you have to be careful how young the kids are, that have them. We actually had a little post about silly bands. There was a child we know of who was sent to the school nurse because basically she was wearing about 100 of these silly bands. And
that's all?
Circulation to her hands.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so. I know a little boy who we've discovered that he might have a little obsessive compulsive thing going on because he's got hundreds and he wears them from his wrist to his shoulder.
Ah, but let me tell you, there are now finger bands and there are toe bands. So, Robin,
look out.
Better warn those parents.
But so there is a chance, of course, as you said, that they could be swallowed, but also that they could cut off circulation. So
yeah, a little common sense.
Yeah, be careful. What's the most serious issue around kids that concerns you right now?
One of the things I'm seeing a lot in my office, I think now, are kind of illnesses and concerns related to sleep deprivation. I think our society now moves so fast. And for example, I have parents who will bring their children in and they're worried that their kids might have ADHD, for example, like attention deficit disorder. But really, the kids have sleep deprivation, and a sleep-deprived young child can't pay attention and can't focus. We see that in teenagers who are showing some anxiety and depression when really they're just sleep-deprived, and if they got enough sleep, they wouldn't have as many symptoms as they have.
What about erasing? It's listed under the favorites right below Bye Bye Binky. Erasing, an unsafe teen game. What's that?
Oh, that's a nasty new game in town. Robin, take a look at the back of your hand.
Mm-hmm.
See those cords that run from your knuckles to your wrists? Now, these cords help extend your fingers. Now, what you do next is look around your studio and take a pencil eraser. And imagine if you and maybe the sound engineer were to take your pencil erasers and then start erasing as fast as you could on top of those cords. First to stop actually loses.
Why would you want to do that?
Because it's a classic game of chicken. You know, when you live forever, and everybody lives forever when you're 14, it's unnerving. I mean, I noticed the other day someone used the search words erasing and scars to actually find that post on the web.
I'm imagining that hurts.
Yes.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
But you're chicken if you stop.
Oh.
You don't win the game.
And do they go as far as, making themselves bleed?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. If you look on the blog post, we have Dr. Lai had the great photograph of one of her patients with scabs from the game.
Ay, ay, ay. Well, Dr. Lai, we should say you both do research. You go to people who are experts in different fields to get answers, including asking a teacher what parents can do when they find their child is lying about schoolwork. What was the answer?
The blog post is what to do when your child comes home and says, "I got 100% on that term paper," when in that reality they got a 60%. And what we did was we turned to a school teacher who was very modest. She actually said, "I only have 25 years of teaching experience." The piece of advice that I thought was the most practical that she gave was, with kids, they always have a reason to lie. And once you understand that reason, whether maybe they're be too embarrassed by their older siblings' wonderful grades, or perhaps they just didn't want to admit failure to a parent, then the lying becomes more understandable.
Finally, before I let you go, what is the scoop on poop?
It's interesting. The poop is fascinating to parents. This is something kind of surprising, I suppose, about pediatrics. Everybody's interested in poop.
Well, because as the book tells us, everybody poops.
Everybody poops, exactly. So we get questions about poop from literally the first couple days that a baby is born. Parents want to know what color is normal and how often and what consistency. But then it kind of moves along to potty training when, 2 and 3 year old's favorite words are mine and no. So they they certainly don't want to give their poop to a potty. So then poop becomes important there. Then the kids get constipated because they don't want to go. And there's that whole cycle that gets built in. Then poop again becomes important because a lot of teenagers, for example, they don't eat right. Maybe they're not exercising. And so they have problems with their pooping, or they're very nervous and anxious and they get, you know, irritable bowel. And then on a really serious note, constipation can also be a sign of drug abuse or drug addiction. So we have to pay attention to poop throughout the childhood, teenagehood, you know, cycle.
Yeah, it's Dr. Lai. We strongly believe that a lot of life's issues all boil down to the essentials of life, which are really eat, sleep, drink, pee, poop, and love. And beyond that, everything else
falls into place.
Wow, I asked for the scoop on poop, and I got it.
You got a scoop on poop.
Sort of soup to nuts right there. That's Dr. Naylene Lai and Dr. Julie Cardos. Their blog is Two Peds in a Pod, as in pediatricians, and we'll link you to them at our website, hearandnow.org. Doctors, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, before we go, let's recap some developments in politics. In a debate this morning in Delaware between Democrat Chris Coons and Republican senatorial candidate Christine O'Donnell, the subject of creationism came up, Coons explaining that the First Amendment called for separation of church and state, to which O'Donnell responded, "So you're telling me the separation of church and state is found in the First Amendment?" Legal scholars in attendance gasped. Then there was last night's gubernatorial debate in New York with Democrat Andrew Cuomo, Republican Carl Paladino, and five other candidates. Personal Freedom Party candidate and former madam Kristen Davis did not mince words.
"The career politicians in Albany are the biggest whores in this state. I might be the only person sitting on this stage with the right experience to deal with them."
Here's Jimmy McMillan of the Rent's Too Damn High Party.
"I represent the Rent's Too Damn High Party. Playing a silly game. It's not going to happen. The Rent Too Damn High movement, the people I'm here to represent can't afford to pay their rent. They can't eat breakfast, lunch, or dinner. Listen, someone's stomach, your child's stomach just growled. Did you hear it? Got to listen like me."
And Libertarian Party candidate Warren Redlick.
"I'm not your typical New York politician. I've never been caught with a prostitute. My dad wasn't governor. And I've never been convicted of a crime."
What a rallying cry. "I've never been convicted of a crime." One last note. In Nevada, Republican Senate candidate Sharon Angle, speaking to a group of Hispanic high school students, told them, "Well, some of you look Asian to me." She went on to say she was once called the first Asian legislator in the Nevada Assembly. She later said she meant people thought she looked Asian. Sharon Angle is blonde and blue-eyed. Well, it's the political silly season. We will keep you posted on all the latest. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.